I just want to start by acknowledging some of the co-authors of this research, and they're in the room also, many of them, Dr. Edith Parker, Barbara Israel, Amy Schultz, and Larissa Larson is not here, but she's part of the team as well. And so I'm going to talk to you all about freight today. Some of you might not think about transportation planning in this way, but when I'm talking about freight, another term is the goods movement, so this idea of the places where our trade goes through. So ships, ports, borders, border crossings, land. So that's kind of the context for all of this, and also rail yards, airports, so you can get into that mindset. I also don't have anything to disclose, and I'm a student as well. So APHA, as many of you might know, has really ventured into the world of talking about transportation and health in a lot of different ways. And this slide is actually to give us some background from a webinar that Dr. Dannenberg did about a year ago, looking at what are all the relationships between health outcomes and traffic-related air pollutants. And so when we're looking at freight, we're looking at different kinds of pollutants. We're looking at particulate matter, ozone, nitrogen oxide, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and then air toxics is this mass category that the EPA tracks. I believe there's a couple hundred of them, and so that's your benzene and your mercury and your other toxics. And so we know that there's a lot of correlations in the literature between these exposures and health outcomes. And so we have a really good understanding about respiratory health and cardiovascular health. There's somewhat of a newer literature on nervous system effects and reproductive effects. So we're starting to see effects potentially with autism and birth defects happening for folks who are living near freight gateways or transportation corridors. And so some of you probably have a general sense of this. And so I'm bringing this up as a background, but there's also many other quality of life factors that come up when you live near a freight gateway. And so thinking about noise pollution, safety issues, and many other topics. But this is just kind of to set the stage. So we have many policies in place to reduce the effects of air pollution near the places we live. The EPA has many policies to do this, but we're seeing many advocates more so, and some researchers are starting to say, but wait a minute, this is an environmental justice issue, because the folks who live near these freight gateways are often low-income communities of color. And so you'll see a lot of work coming out of California, and so near the ports of Long Beach and the ports of LA, there's a lot of advocacy happening. And actually, I went to a really great poster session yesterday about some of this work in Long Beach, and so they really kind of have given us some motivation and inspiration and new ways to think about how to address these issues. And so actually, their state Air Resources Board said, the Californians who live near ports, rail yards, and along traffic corridors are subsidizing the goods movement sector with their health. So the idea that we're all benefiting across the country when the trade gets to our Target and our Walmart, but the communities that live where these containers and transfers are happening are feeling the burden. And so a few years ago, the EPA did an initial screening, and they worked with a group, I think it was ICF, they tried to do some modeling around some of the ports, focusing on seaports specifically, and saw that very much so this is what the advocates are saying is happening, that this demographic composition is the case. There's not a lot of details in this report, but you can find another article by Arlene Rosenbaum that wrote in the American Journal of Public Health a few years ago that talked about this report. And so kind of seeing what is this pattern and should we be concerned. And so one of the big issues is that in international waters, we aren't able to deal with emissions the same way we are within our borders. And even when we have policies in place, we have a lot of older trucks on the road. And then once we make things more efficient and have good transportation planning, we find that a lot of times the research suggests that we add a lane, and that ends up actually just increasing traffic flow because we get more people going that way. And so things don't always work the way we want them to. So there's very much still these issues at play. So this is part of my dissertation research, and I'm actually just going to focus on the second part for this presentation. But if you want to follow me on down to the exhibit hall in South Building, I'll be presenting a poster on the qualitative piece of this research. And so I did two case studies in Long Beach and in Detroit, Michigan, where there's a proposal for a new bridge going on. In Long Beach, there's the ports and development that happens there. Looking at it from it's institutional ethnography, so how do residents in those communities partake in the environmental assessment process? We know that there's scoping, and we know that there's a stepwise process, but how do folks actually engage in that, and what does that look like? And I can talk all about it with you in a few hours. if you're interested. And then today I'm going to talk about the spatial analysis. So what is this pattern, and is it happening? And so I'm going to use the term host community, and so I define it with another ambiguous word, community neighborhoods. So where neighborhoods where people live and major freight transport infrastructure is located. And so the reason it's somewhat vague is that in different places, these neighborhoods and communities are different sizes. At the Port of Long Beach and the Port of Los Angeles, you can use 710 corridor. That's a bigger community that's affected maybe by a border crossing in North Dakota. That's a smaller community affected. So I'm going to use that term to kind of frame this. So when I'm talking about the freight gateways, this is a map from the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. These are kind of the big players where a lot of our trade is happening. This is the top 25 sites where we see most of the trade in the United States, and you'll see Port of Los Angeles is number one, and then two and three fall on the East Coast of New York, and I'm not sure what's happening there with the weather right now, but a lot of what's happening economically in this country is happening in these locations. And so what I decided to do was take the top 50 sites and to try to really understand who lives around these areas. Excuse me. And so I used data from the American Community Survey, and I used five-year estimates so that we could get kind of the most current, and because these different communities kind of have different levels of population, it was an ideal data set because you can also get more variables out of it. You can look at things that you can't pick up in the census. And these are all not ones. I don't know what happened there. So number two, I pulled boundary state files for U.S. Census Tract. So if you do anything with GIS, you go to Tiger and you can get those pretty easily. And then the hard part was digitizing freight gateway shape files. So basically, it's digitizing is just drawing maps. And so these are just a few examples of the Port of Long Beach and then an example from the Atlanta airport. And then you can vaguely see there's a black buffer, and I'll talk about that in a second. But so to validate this, it's hard to basically, there's different governance structures for different ports across the country, and so to really pull this data in a consistent way is a little tricky. And so I did turn to the folks who did the EPA report and asked, you know, they sent me some of their screenshots and I could make comparisons and use Google Earth and talk to some of the port authorities. But again, there are 50 different sites, so it's not a perfect analysis, but I think it gives us a good sense of the pattern when you go through it. And so, and another thing to keep in mind is it's probably rather conservative in that I stuck with the public lands. And so, as I said, some of this is some sprawling infrastructure with private entities connecting and private rail yards next door. And so it's probably a much larger community that is affected in most of these places. And so this is kind of the nitty-gritty if you do any spatial analysis. But basically, the stepwise process that I'm not going to get too into, but this idea of aerial weighting. So I'm trying to make an estimate based on who lives in the census tract, and you kind of splice it to say if this is the whole census tract, then you draw a 500-meter buffer around the Port of Long Beach, what part of that census tract is falling in that buffer, and try to pull out the data that way. And so the reason I went with a 500-meter buffer is I referenced this Health Effects Institute did a meta-analysis where they looked at all of the different air pollution studies that they could come up with in looking at traffic and how far people were, and to say that, you know, people are affected beyond this range, of course, but a lot of the impact happens at 300 to 500 meters. And locally, you can get more detailed. You can do modeling, and you can look at, you know, wind patterns. And but overall, nationally, I decided to go with this 500-meter number. So what did I find? So this is a comparison table just looking at host communities, and so using that term of all the different 50 sites and the 500 meters above, around them, and who lives in them. And so you'll see a notable difference between, if you just look at the bold column and not get lost in the numbers, you'll see that in host communities there was 21 about percent more persons of color than the general U.S. population. And again, with the Hispanic population, about 20% more. About 6% more people in host communities had less than high school education than in the general U.S. population. And about 4% more had were below poverty than in the general U.S. population. And so unemployment was about the same. So there, my theory and what these advocates were saying is holding true. And so we're seeing this pattern potentially. Obviously, this isn't correlational. This is just looking at a comparison between. And so then I zoomed in a little bit more to the top 10 gateways. And the reason I did this is because about 60% of our trade, or I'm sorry, 40% of our trade goes through these sites, and about 60% of the people that I pulled out all across the country live near these sites. So they're getting higher traffic of trucks and of trade, and so I wanted to see what was going on specifically there. And so the numbers got even bigger. You'll see poverty was, I believe, 4% difference between the general U.S. population and the people living around those communities. And in this instance, when you just look at the top 10 sites, it goes up to 12%, which is a difference between, you know, in the general population, they're saying 16%, and then in this area, it's about 28%. So there's a notable difference of who's being affected here. And so then I wanted to see, doing the qualitative interviews, I got more context, I got more stories, and so I got this complete understanding. And if you go to many of these communities, you see that there's also lots of industry. We put transportation near industry because it makes sense economically, and so I wanted to see how this played out, and I used just one example with the toxic release inventory, where sites that have chemical waste disposal are required to report, and there's many others I could also look at. So there's folks who have to comply with RCRA and Superfund sites and many others, but just sticking to toxic release sites, and found that there were 255 facilities in these host communities. So across all of the 50 sites, the 500-meter borders, buffers, there were 255 facilities there. And so when I compared this to the general U.S., all the tracks in the United States, that's actually about the same. But then when you look at the whole community, so the buffers, not the tracks, but at the buffer level, you'll see that these communities are 2.33 times more likely to have a facility than not. And so the idea that if they do have a facility, they have multiple facilities is kind of the take-home there. It's a little confusing, but the idea that there's probably some cumulative exposures happening and that's something to be talking about when we're doing the transportation planning, that these communities are already affected by all these other sites. And so there's often, this is an example from Southwest Detroit, the red dots are all industrial sites that report to the toxic release inventory. And so you'll see we have our Ambassador Bridge, which is our current crossing, and then there's below that there's a proposed crossing border. And so you'll see if I actually do the 500-meter buffer around the Ambassador Bridge, which I didn't put on there, there's no facilities reporting in Detroit, but you'll see they're very close to many facilities. And so I think Laura's going to talk about cumulative effects and indices later, so we can get some insight there. So from a policy side of things, what does this mean when we talk about environmental justice issues? The EPA has, you know, the Executive Order 12898 that focuses on environmental justice and defines what an environmental justice community is. And so I won't read the definition to you all, but to just think about what does this mean in this context. And so at these sites, when we're putting in a new development or we're adding to a current development, we go through this environmental assessment process, and there's an EJ analysis, and so we look at who lives in the area. But as you'll see in many of these communities, the analysis often focuses on, it's project-specific is my understanding, and so if this area is where we're looking at what the health impacts are, we can say, oh, air quality will be improved. We're going to make it more efficient. We're going to, you know, improve technology, and so things are going to get better. But oftentimes it's this small part of this community over here where all the trucks are now going to be, and so that doesn't get picked up in an environmental justice analysis always. And so to just kind of be thinking about that, an example of that is in Southern California. Again, there's many of you have heard of the SCIG, is a rail yard proposal that's going on right now. And so right there, they actually, the community was very upset with the environmental assessment that came out, and so they reissued and recirculated another environmental impact assessment statement because of this issue of scope, geographic scope. And so we kind of have to figure out what that means. And so I said I wasn't going to do the qualitative piece, but I wanted to share a couple quotes because I think they can be quite powerful in adding some context to, you know, when I tell a couple people I'm studying this, they say, oh, you want to know who lives near bridges? That's not very exciting and interesting, but when you get this context, it really, to me, makes it more meaningful and powerful. So this is from a community organizer in Long Beach, and she said, we found out that we were referred to in Sacramento as the environmental sacrifice zone. It doesn't sound very friendly, does it? Basically, you know, well, okay, well, that place is already ruined, so let's just put everything down there. Let's not ruin other pristine areas. Let's just keep degrading the ones that already are degraded. That phrase, environmental sacrifice zone, well, who wants to live in an environmental sacrifice zone? And then in Detroit, at the bridge proposal, they said, a community organizer said, Residents came in mass to say, no, you cannot build that bridge in our community. What was more surprising to me was the issue of race. No one said it, but it was always implied, and it was implied to me, a code word, because they would get up and say things like, oh, they will not build a bridge in our community because we're good people. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, where are the bad people? You know, where the hell is that line? I want to know where that line starts that divides the good people from the bad people. So what is the implication when they say, don't do it in our neighborhood, don't do it in our community because we are the good people? So just to offer some context to some of that data. So really quickly, I'll just wrap up and talk about, you know, obviously this isn't talking, I didn't look at the health effects that were happening in these areas. There's plentiful studies going on of great epidemiologists who are doing that work. The aerial weighting technique is quite imperfect. It plays out differently if you're in a rural area, if you're in an urban area. And so while there's many people doing it, there's lots of talk about how that should be done scope-wise geographically as well. And so, but I do think that this gives us a general sense of a pattern that is concerning and that there's opportunities to address. And so next steps for research and policy and practice. In terms of research, coming up in the qualitative is that there's a lot of things that aren't documented by looking at where a TIR facility is or where the traffic corridor is. And so community members talked about how they did truck counts on residential roads to see what wasn't being picked up by the local transportation authorities. And so how can we get that data conveyed to policymakers? And then again, localized analyses that do look at up and down the traffic corridor and what's happening, I think, are still very important. And then some kind of moving past where we're at with environmental justice research and talking about the economic effects and the quality of life effects that are happening. And so I didn't put up the data about vacancy near these areas, but what I found was that about 20% of the 50 communities had home vacancy rates of between 20 and 45% in those areas. So the quality of life and the economics of what's going on in some of these communities can affect public health, obviously, and so I want to explore that a little more. I think, obviously, we can be talking to transportation planners a little bit more and seeing what we can do to address some of these issues. And then more effective integration of public health and environmental justice into the risk assessment process and decisions. It's there, but how can we do it more meaningfully? So with that, I want to acknowledge my dissertation committee, many who are here, community members of Long Beach in California and Detroit who have been instrumental in this, a student at Wayne State, Nate Barnes, who has helped quite a bit with the data analysis, and then Rackham Graduate School at University of Michigan, who funded some of this work. Thank you.